Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 1, delivered on January 12, 2010. The title of this lecture is Introduction to the Discipline.
Today, Introduction to the Discipline. Financial management is the topic of this course, but more generally, this is about business finance. In business finance, we can teach three different areas of focus. This one we'll try to survey it, but focus on the financial management. The three areas of focus in business, in finance, as a discipline, is the financial management. That is the internal analysis of the numbers associated with costs and revenues of the firm. That's financial management. The second area of finance is financial markets and institutions, where the flows of capital move. That could be through brokerage houses, banks, trusts, other structures where money moves, money is stored, money is transferred. The third area of finance is investments, where money is put to earn money, or where money is acquired for projects that are worthy of investment. Now, these three areas of finance are actually intertwined quite a bit. And we can cabin the discussion in an elementary course. But this is financial management. This is investments. This is financial institutions and markets. All I can say, well, these are obviously separate. I won't do that to you. I will allow for the spillage and say, well, for example, if I am a financial person within a firm, a financial manager of a firm, I do have to look at the costs and the revenues from the projects that are being undertaken, but I also have to know what to do with the money that I generate from those. Where would that money go? If I make money on something, what do I do with it? Do I give it to the shareholders as a dividend? Do I plow it back into investments of the firm? Or do I possibly even go out and put that money into other investments outside of the firm, like stocks and bonds of other firms? So there is that obvious connection there. When I have a project and I'm analyzing a project for a firm, internally, I still have to know, at least to some extent, okay, what are the conditions of the financial markets right now? What interest rates are being charged by banks? Are these interest rates consistent with investment in this project? If I have a project that is going to give me an internal rate of return of 8% and the prevailing interest rate environment for capital for that project is 6%, obviously it's a go. But if interest rates go up to 9%, that formerly very desirable project suddenly becomes a no-go. There is no middle ground, yes or no. We're not nuanced in business. Philosophy is for when we're drunk or stoned, okay? When we're clear of our minds, it's yes or no on a project. If capital costs me 9% and the project returns me 8%, that project goes to hell. You see, this is where we actually begin to have to look into the political and economic environment, macro environment. What is the Fed, the Federal Reserve, going to be doing over the next year? Well, is the Fed going to pursue an easy money policy like it has for the last 9 years, just printing money like there's no tomorrow to feed a government that has become completely outsized? Or is the Fed suddenly going to realize, oh my God, this is creating inflation, run, 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 and start to crank up interest rates? Well, if the Fed doesn't crank up those interest rates, they'll go up on their own, I promise you. And so what does that mean for our investments in projects, the prevailing interest rate environment, and our expectations for the future? So you see, there is a lot of nuance and a lot of interconnections in finance with the within the different parts, and also with the political and economic environment out there. Also, the legal environment tends to impact on us. Whenever there is a problem, well, let's kick the ass of business. Let's make a new law. Let's make a new rule. Let's make a new regulation. You would have a lot of learn a lot more about that in a class I teach in business law. But I will address it in here too, because the legal and regulatory environment actually impacts upon us in just trying to do business. Look, the textbook and a lot of other resources I've seen, it gives a statement, well, finance is a combination of accounting and economics. True enough, we use accounting data, raw accounting data. No doubt about that. But we are not accountants. Accountants deal in historical, measurable, documentable cost. We can't do that. We use accounting numbers. You'll see accounting numbers all the time in this class. I'll bring up financial statements prepared by accountants. We'll break them down, do ratios and all that kind of stuff, project cash flow. We'll do that. But we have to recognize at the end of the day that accounting numbers are not the whole story. As a matter of fact, in some ways, they are not even the story at all. We always have to keep that in mind. We are far, far more economics-oriented in these classes. Thank God you have the greatest teacher in the world. I teach economics as well. I'm a financial economist by craft, by trade. I'm a financial economist. And I'll tell you right now, when I talk about cost in finance, I'm talking about the same kind of cost we talk about in economics. Let's try this. 3 years from now, you have you have graduated from this fine institution. Madam, I never see you. You don't write. You don't call. You don't come home for dinner. But one day you show up at my office. Professor C, I wanted to tell you, I started my own business. I started a coffee shop here in town. And you know what? The year just ended, my fiscal year, my first year, I made $20,000 in profit. Give me a high five. And you know what I'll tell you? Burn your business to the ground. Jeez. Get a job! Do you know why I'm going to do that to her?
No.
Because she could have gone out with a degree from this place, and especially since she took at least one course from me, she could go out there to State Barn and get a job for $60,000 a year. You didn't make $20,000, you lost $40,000 because the opportunity cost of that $20,000 was $60,000. So economically speaking, you lost $40,000. Loser. You think that's not the way it is? Would you be in this class if you had a call from Chicago, a modeling agency wants to pay you $1,000 an hour? Would you be in this class? You'd last be seen leaving town in a late model Huff. I'm out of here. If you could get a starring role in a movie opposite Johnny Depp, and you get to kick Johnny Depp's ass over and over again in the movie, which he deserves, would you be here? No. You're rational. You're a rational person. You suddenly realize that you're incredible at golf. You can live like Tiger Woods. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Yeah. Honk, honk. Would you be here? Oh, hell no. Don't give me that. Well, I love you, Professor Z. I'm going to stick with this class. No, you wouldn't. You would never do that. You see, we react to opportunity cost, to the cost of the best foregone alternative, not to accounting cost. Accounting costs are actually some of the smallest costs. Tell you a story. Some years back, when I was doing a gig at a certain private snooty institution here in town, teaching, we had the mayor of the town come in to speak to all the finance students. It was an evening with the mayor, who was at the time promoting this grand vision of an arena for this city. Oh, well, it was for this, our twin here. So she brought her financial manager with her, this big woman and her scrawny little boy come in. And all the kids just sat there and listened. And she said, tell them how great it is. Go, go, go. And so he put up the financials, the financial projections. First of all, the revenues were just ridiculous. He said that there would be a radius of draw of, who am I kidding? We're talking about Bloomington. A radius of draw of 60 miles for people buying tickets. Oh, that was ridiculous. But then he went to the cost side. And he went through it all. Nice financial analysis. He certainly knows how to use an Excel spreadsheet. When it was over, he said, are there any questions? And of course, the students were all very proper. They act very proper over there. And then they go out and get wasted and laid after. But no one asked anything, although I did see around that room there were people I know saw it. As a matter of fact, they said later that they were afraid to say anything. I raised my hand, being one of the professors, I can be an asshole. And I said, where's the cost of the land? Oh, we own the land. I said, you own the land. Well, isn't that nice? He knew right there. It looked like he was having visions of being dog meat. You see, it doesn't matter if you own the land. It's still a cost of the project because you can sell the land. You could rent the land. You have to include the opportunity cost of the best foregone alternative to using anything in a project. If I take you, sir, and put you on one project from another, that is a cost to where you were in my firm. You're not free. Maybe someone paid $20 an hour. You're not free. You see, you're a cost, even if you're already part of the firm. Every day you drive that. Do you have a car?
Yes.
Oh, I think I saw your car. It's lame. But no, every day you drive that car. Now, that car's probably not worth a lot, but suppose that suddenly it becomes a classic on eBay. It's selling for $500,000 copies of that car. Are you going to have any emotional attachment to that car at all? No, you're not. Yeah, you're going to say sold. You see, because the cost now, you don't see the opportunity cost. But if the price went up, you would begin to see that opportunity cost emerging. This is what we have to do in finance, is we have to think about what are the full costs of projects. What are the consequences of profits that are reported? Many are the times in financial analysis when I teach investment courses, I'll say, this company just posted a $16 million profit and its stock went down. Are the markets irrational? Never. What the investment world is saying is that profit should have been a whole lot more than $16 million. So we're going to beat that company's ass, because it did not meet our expectations. So we're going to find other things to do with our money. We're going to pull our capital out of there, drive the stock price down, and put our money somewhere else. See, that's how we have to think about things. And also, expectations are hugely important. Cost, in and of itself, is not important. Let's try an example here. Look around this room. Who the hell? Oh, yeah, you. You own a gas station. You have your own little gas station shirt. It says Bud. When you lean over to fix a tire, your crack shows. The whole nine yards. You're a very proud man. You have this little office, this little gas station office. You can sit there and watch your little black and white TV. You can come out and be very friendly to the customers, offer to wipe their windows and all that kind of stuff. Now, you've just gotten your last load of gas, and you paid $2.25 a gallon, and you bought 10,000 gallons. Now, you step out and you look at the gas stations around you. There's nothing anti-competitive about looking at this. This is how we do price signaling. And everyone's around $2.50 a gallon. So you mark your gas up 25 cents. And so the retail price you're charging is $2.50. Everything's okay. That's a markup, your reasonable markup, around 10%. And then you go back into your little side gas station. You see everyone else is about the same price. There's plenty of demand for everyone around the area. So you sell your gasoline, you make your normal profit and all that kind of stuff. And then you're back there sitting and you're watching your television. And the news flash comes on. You know that guy who tried to blow up the airliner over Detroit? Well, someone else was planning it too and put more explosives in his underwear. And not only did he blow up the plane, but he blew up parts of himself too. Huge explosion. President Obama declares war on everyone because he doesn't want to look soft on terrorism. And the world explodes. Iran mines the Strait of Hormuz. Saudi Arabia goes into an authoritarian lockdown as Al-Qaeda elements come out of the woodwork. Somalia becomes a hotbed where Al-Qaeda operatives flow out into the Middle East, show up along the travel routes for the big oil tankers. There are fires in oil fields across the Middle East. The wholesale price of gasoline shoots to $8 a gallon. You bought yours at $2.25. What are you going to charge? Are you still going to, you're going to sit there on your fat ass and keep your price at $2.50? You go out there and you look around and everyone else has gone to $8.25 a gallon. Okay, now I want you to think about this. You're about to go out there and change your sign, but you're a good Christian. And suddenly before you open the door and this blinding light hits you. And angels sing, Hosanna, and there is Jesus looking at you. My son, thou hast lived a good life, but thou hast yielded to greed. You got that gas at $2.25 a gallon.
I sold for $8.24.
Burn in hell, sucker. My son, don't do this. Don't do this. Turn away from the high-priced gasoline, just as thou hast turned away from the buttocks and away from all of the other things of this world. Please, son. You have to say, get out of the way, Jesus! I gotta raise my price! You know why? Because when you buy your next load of gasoline, what's it gonna cost you?
$8.
You got it, Ace. So you know what? If you don't go to the market, you are out of business. Oh, but I love my customers. I got this gas at a low price, so I'm going to sell it at a low price to my customers because they're loyal to me. Well, you know what? They're going to chew up your gas at $2.50 a gallon, and then they're just going to drive right by your station and get the gas from the others because they are no more loyal to you than you should be to them. Really? We love our customers. Well, I love staying in business a whole lot more. Replacement cost is what matters, not historical cost. Replacement cost is what matters. Do you understand why? What I'm doing here is I'm trying to dislocate your thinking from pure accounting numbers. Yes, we have to use them. But at the end of the day, we have to recognize that the rules of accounting, generally accepted standards for writing down numbers, compel the accountants to have documentation. This is a historical cost. I can document it, I can represent it. But in finance and economics, we have to look beyond that and say, what is the real cost? And the vast majority of cost is replacement cost and opportunity cost. Remember, you as the owner deserve a fair return. If you don't get it, you will go. Eventually, you're not going to be happy with making $20,000 in profit a year when you can work at State Barn for $60,000 a year. You're just not going to stay in the business forever under those conditions. You might ride it for a while. God knows I had businesses. I held on. Couldn't cover my own cost, but it was like a hidden cost. I was proud of myself that I had enough money to eat at White Castle a few nights a week. If I don't know how many do you all know what White Castles are, right? They're little tiny cheeseburgers. They give you cramps, and they're really good. We need White Castle. But seriously, I mean, it was just like I could make my payroll, so I stayed in business. But I wasn't paying myself what I was worth, and eventually Clueville called me and I said, oh, I see, I'm not making what I could doing something else, so I stopped doing that thing that wasn't making me what I could do other things. Now that is not to discount that there are other motives other than physical money. The goal of the firm, as many of you have been taught, you have actually been told, the goal of the firm is to maximize profit. That's not right. That's not correct. A better way to represent it is to say that the goal of the firm is to maximize the value of the firm, which theoretically should maximize the wealth of the owners of the firm. So the goal of the firm and our goal in financial management and the goal of the marketing department, the goal of the operations management wing, the goal of all of us is to maximize the value of the firm. That's not the same as maximizing profit. Profit is a proxy for value, but profit is not the only thing that drives value of a firm. We see firms that suck, that when they are taken in hostile action, their value is skyrocketing, way above what profit would tell us. Is that some irrationality? Oh, hell no. The value is actually beginning to show through the red ink on the financial statements. That's what's usually happening. So keep that in mind, is that we do use accounting numbers. We do talk about profit maximization. But behind all of that, there are these deeper concepts and deeper goals and deeper thinking that we have when we work in our craft here in finance and in economics. And so that, and also, this gives you another window on this whole point about how I can't teach you ethics. You have your own morals, and if you do wrong, you will get caught and you'll be some hard-timer's old lady at a federal facility or bunk with Large Marge if you're a lady. But you see, I don't teach you ethics because that's not how we make the greatest world. You're a bread maker. You make bread. Now, there's no other bread makers in this whole town. So you can charge whatever you want. You're a monopolist. You can charge, the technical term is you can charge out the ass for your bread. You can be sloppy. I mean, you pass the cost off. You take the flour, you throw it into the bin. Oops, spill half of it. Well, whatever. You hire your lazy-ass brother here. He doesn't do anything, but mother bitches at you. You should hire him. So you hire him. And he sits in the back room playing Wii games. Dance, Dance Revolution. He's damn good at it. But you see, you're making huge money. And you're a slob. You really are. Now, have you ever seen anybody who makes way more money than he or she deserves? Bill Gates comes to mind for me. Tiger Woods. Shouldn't all be his. He's still going to come out of it very wealthy. I mean, dude, you have half of $1 billion. You still got a lot of girls who will like you even though you're ugly as shit. Okay? But you see, here's the deal, though. Greed is not bad. If there is someone like you making money, being a slob, all you would have to do is just not make waste your resources. Just use the existing resources more efficiently, and you can have lower cost and charge a lower price. And you will do that because you can make money doing it. That's what we call static efficiency, just using the existing resources more efficiently. But you're using the same technology. And here I take the side point to tell you that you have been lied to about technology. They use the word technology all the time now, as if technology is this lame-ass thing right here. Technology in the classroom. Technology in your home. Technology in your ass. That's not technology. Technology is merely the combination of factors of production you bring to bear on inputs, on your factors, to create an output. That's all technology is. We've had technologies from making spears, to making guns, to making movies, to making bread. But in this case, you didn't change the technology. All you did was use the resources more efficiently. That's static technology. I'm sorry, static efficiency. But now, here you see, wait a minute, I could do this whole bread making thing. He uses people to knead loaves of bread. I could make a machine that would do very large loaves of dough, pound them, and it would be a lot cheaper than how he does it. You could change the combination of factors of production. In other words, you could move to a new technology. That's dynamic efficiency. That's dynamic efficiency. Moving from one technology to another to reduce cost. Why are you doing this? You're doing it for the same reason he's doing it, for the same reason you were in business to begin with. It has nothing to do with whether you love yourself, your customers. We say that all the time. We're in business to serve our community and love our customers. Oh, bullshit! Your whole reason for doing this is to drive him out of business, put him into bankruptcy, and make his kids go to Illinois State University. Oh, God, I'm podcasting this, Jesus. You see, it's not about kumbaya holding hands. You cooperate until it is no longer in your interest to cooperate. Your basic reason for being in business is to make money, to do right for yourself, do right for the owners of the company. Okay? That's what we're in business for. And we can talk about ethics all day long, but at the end of the day, we still have to have the incentive to make money, to live better, to see to it that our kids live better than our parents and we did. That, if you take away that incentive, you know what you've got? You got that there socialism. That's what you got. I'm not discounting socialism, but in our system, we are driven by the profit motive. We are driven by greed. Now, let me make one last point about greed. You're making bread. You've done a good job, low-priced bread. Now, suppose your bread isn't very good. It gets so bad that you have to put up a sign above your shop, "My bread tastes like ass." Mother takes her kid up to the bread store. "No, mommy, I don't want that bread. That bread tastes like ass." "Oh, shut up. There are kids starving in China who'd love to have an ass sandwich." You are not going to sell butt bread unless you've got a good infomercial. I don't dismiss niche marketing, but ass bread doesn't sell. You're not going to stay in business if you make a product that sucks, unless you're Microsoft. But you see, there's the problem. Microsoft is a monopolist. You see, there's the thing about it. Competition is a bitch. We hate it because we have to deal with our competitors. We have to fight the market every day. We go into the hustle and flow of corporate America and fight our way through. But that's where it all is. You see, that's what forces us to be better, to be more efficient. You take that out of the system. Like in healthcare reform, they're going to make people who don't have healthcare insurance buy health insurance from oligopolists who sell defective products. That is not how you fix a market. We are not going to tell the hospitals to start showing their prices. We're not going to force the doctors to say, "Here is what we charge," so that the consumer can have power in the market. We're not doing that. All we're doing is we're saying, "Let's leave the oligopolists in place." That is not reform. Because that does not bring about the power of competition, which is to bring static efficiencies to market and then dynamic efficiencies to markets. You take that out of any kind of reform, you don't have reform at all. You have repair. Enough of the political shit. Where the hell was I? Oh, yeah. I don't talk about ethics. We, at the end of the day, we do have what our upbringing and our family, our religion, and we refer to those. But it's like one of my greatest business teachers from 40 years ago said to me, "Love your family, pray to your God, and go out and crush your competition." Okay? So that's how it works in this class. Now, in this class, there are actually three types of firms. I talk about the firm, the company. But there are actually three types of firms out there. And we're going to focus on the corporation. But we can start with the simplest organization of a firm, which is a sole proprietorship, a one-person show. You own a truck.
I have a truck. I'll drive your ass anywhere.
You have a lawnmower.
I'll mow your lawn.
Uh-huh. You see, in this very simple, and actually some of my most successful work is in sole proprietorships. My photography studio is a sole proprietorship. All the profit is mine, and all the risk is mine. There's no real company there. It's just me. So if I screw up, they can go right through the company's assets and take everything I own, too, in an enterprise like this. That's why I have insurance to try to protect me a little bit. You, if you're just mowing lawns, if you run over someone's fancy little dog, they'll take your lawnmower, your car, and everything else you own, even though it's sad stuff you own. See, that's the problem, is you're all at risk. You keep all the profit, you bear complete risk, and it can be unlimited. There's no limit on your liability. So that's a sole proprietorship. Now, there are other organizational forms, too, that begin to work around some of the issues, but in general, let me first of all write down the sole proprietorship. And it's the simplest organizational form. Now, don't get me wrong. Actually, as a consultant, I formed corporations. That was one of my bread and butter things. I can make corporations. In some circumstances, I just don't want to. There's no point in going through all the paperwork and all of the administrative stuff. One of the great burdens I realized as a business person First, there was always this, especially after I got employed, there was this thing about, I got to make payroll. And that was just like every 2 weeks, just like this, God, can I do this? But there was also just this ungodly administrative burden, filling out this form, that form, for the state, for the feds, for this and that, for the city. I mean, just always having to keep your eye on compliance standards, what's EEOC say, what's OSHA say, and all that. And I mean, I can make a corporation. Why would I when I can do this stuff myself and just lie low as a sole proprietor? Okay, that's the first level of organization. Now, the second level of organization is what we call a partnership, and there are all kinds of partnership structures. Essentially, a partnership is a sharing of all the risk and all of the cash flow. It's like a sole proprietorship of more than one person. Now, there are all kinds, as I said, just different variations and twists on it. There's a general partnership, and then there are limited partnership where there is a general partner, and then there are these partners who will get a little bit of money from the partnership, but they don't get the lion's share if there's money made, but they also don't bear the full blow of the unlimited liability. So those kinds of limited liability partnerships, and I actually did some of those in the old days, structured them and then sold units of limited partnership units. You can do those for everything from, in my time, we did them for low-income housing for the elderly. There was one where I ran into the indie movie circuit. Limited partnerships are very common or at least they were, I don't know how they are now, but back in the day, for the indie movie circuit, interestingly for porn movies back in that time, the limited partnerships were very big stuff. The limited partners were not allowed to do anything as far as management goes. They just sat back, put their money in, and then stayed off to the side, and if money was made, they got some of that money. Interestingly, the most popular of the limited partnerships that I dealt in were the ones where these partnerships lost money. And people would just line up for these because they were going to lose money. And you think, what? Yeah, because you see, if I sell a unit, $20,000 a unit for a limited partnership to rich doctors and lawyers and dentists and optometrists, they put in $20,000, and then that partnership builds low-income housing for the elderly, loses money every year. What the rich people who invested get is two different tickets. One says you lost this much money on as far as profit goes. It was a loss, which they can write off against their practice income. And then you also get this depreciation, too, which you can write off as use against your taxable income. So those were hugely popular, and they actually lost money. You see, there's a great example of where maximizing profit was most definitely not what we wanted to do. We wanted to maximize value to the owners of this company. And to maximize value was to create as much of a tax shield as we could against their income in their profession. So you see that distinction there between profit and value? Those were very popular in the day. Now, the pinnacle of the company concept is the corporation. And this is where we will focus in this course. You'll hear me tell you stories about sole proprietorships and partnerships. I'll kick those around every now and then. But the principal focus of this course is on the public corporation. A public corporation essentially sells units of ownership to the public. That's called stock. The typical kind is called common stock, and I'll go back through this later. I'm giving you the introduction. This table actually keeps moving. Anyway. But here's how a corporation works. And I'll tell you just really quickly how we would have formed a corporation back in my time as a consultant. First, you have the people who have the idea we want to have a corporation. And we get together, we talk about it, and they retain my services. And I say, okay, now we're going to have a first organizational meeting of the founders. I say, well, what does that mean? It means we're going to have a meeting. And from that meeting, I'm going to create a document called the Articles of Incorporation. Now, the Articles of Incorporation will have some necessary components in them to meet compliance standards. Now, the name of the corporation, the registered address in the state of business, where you are going to incorporate. The state of incorporation does not have to be the state where you are going to do your primary business. Some states are much more favorable. Their general corporation law is old and very good. Like, for example, Delaware. Just ancient general corporation law. They have a chancery court system where the judges are fully trained in law, just completely conversant. The legislature does not pass laws that are mean to corporations. So I might say, well, let's incorporate in Delaware, even though we are, say, in Ohio, where we're doing our work. Okay, well, you've decided on where the corporation is going to be incorporated. You also, in this document, will name a statutory agent for the service of process. In other words, a lawyer or someone who's designated to get court documents or documents from the state, okay, and from the federal government. Now, once these articles, everything has been decided at this first meeting, and it's kind of it's a mark of how lame I am. There was something kind of like a rush. I did a lot of corporation stuff in Texas and stuff like that. And that night we had that organizational meeting, we always made sure we had it at a restaurant where there were lots of big steaks and drinks and all that. And yeah, we're all in business. We're going to do this. You get the Articles of Incorporation. I'd get them all put together, get the founders to sign. Now, there would be a statement in the Articles of Incorporation. Upon the submission of these articles, the organizer's powers will go away, and the directors will take over. Now, the directors will take over according to a document called the bylaws, which essentially lays out all the positions of the executives and the directors and all the responsibilities and all that. Now, these articles of incorporation are sent in triplicate. I don't know how it is now, though. I can't say that. But you send them to the Secretary of State of the state of incorporation. You don't send them to the federal government. A corporation is an entity at the state level, not at the federal level. It's a state entity. So you will submit these articles to the Secretary of State of the state of incorporation. Secretary of State will look at them to make sure that they are in order. The Secretary of State does not approve articles of incorporation. The Secretary of State qualifies if they are not defective. And there will be a stamp put on them, and you'll get back a copy. You're sending them so many copies so that they can send you back one for your proof. That is exactly, in the corporate world, the equivalent of a birth certificate. Those articles of incorporation with the Secretary of State stamp on it, that is the birth certificate of the corporation. Literally recognizing the corporation as a separate entity from its owners under the law. No longer can any creditor come to the owners. They must go to the corporation. And once the corporation has exhausted its funds in dealing with its liabilities, there is no further that the creditors can go. They cannot come and get your ass. You are separate from the corporation. Have you all been in accounting? Look. You remember that famous fundamental accounting equation, assets equals total liabilities plus owner's equity? I'll bet you weren't told that that plus sign is the wall of separation. That's why we write it that way. Those liabilities are separate by law. A court would have to have compelling evidence, and I'll tell you a story about that later, to pierce the corporate veil and go after the owners of a corporation. Otherwise, those owners just walk away. Okay? That's how you can see men like Donald Trump, who are failures in business. Over and over again, he has wrecked companies. He has lost huge money for investors. But there he is, prancing around on the stage. You're fired. Well, Donald, you should be fired too, because you are a failure as a business person. But there he is, filthy rich. Why? Because he is protected by the corporate veil from the failures of the corporations that he creates. Just like many of the wealthy people out there. They're not successes. The corporate concept is a success because it cabins the risk. And that allows us to take greater risks. That's the power of it, is that we can do projects that I would never do, some things I'd like to do, I would never do as a sole proprietor, because, I mean, if something went wrong, I would lose everything I own unless I were incorporated. You see, so this is a power because it allows us to, as a capitalist system, to move capital into projects where the risk would otherwise, we're not stupid. I'm not going to take a risk that is dangerous. You see, I'm picking on certain people. You ever go to the movies?
Yeah.
Okay, you know, do you watch TV?
Yeah.
Ghost Hunters? Oh, that's good. You see, we'll watch TV and movies where there is horror. People walk into a house and the house says, get out! And they go on in. The house says, I'm going to cut you to pieces by the end of the movie. They go on in. You see, in real life, you're not going to do that. You're not stupid. In the house, you open the door and the house says, get out! You're just going to shut the door. FTS. You see? The corporation allows us to live in the movie world in a way because it allows us to be observers instead of the players who can end up being tossed around in parts and pieces like ham hocks in the real world. Now, this course is going to go on from here. I want you to read the first chapter and think about all the wonderful things that just happened to you in this last hour and 15 minutes. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.